There are those people who are primarily close to Wall Street banking cartel, to their largest client corporations, who are definitely struggling to retain hegemony around the world, to continue being a colonial power. And since 28 February, it seems to me that it's the neocolonialist faction which has now prevailed and secured the clutch of the actual policy. The IMF insists on the Donbas because, okay, the IMF is a, let's say, a cutout of a global banking cartel. So these are largely private interests that masquerade behind an international aid organization, let's call it that. Basically, because Donbass was about 80% of the Ukraine's GDP, so Ukraine without the Donbass was worth much less than Ukraine with Donbass. But the selfish people of Donbass didn't want to share those resources with the Western bankers, so it had to be taken by force.
Welcome to World Affairs in Context. I'm Lena Petrova, and today I'm very excited for the conversation we're about to have with Alex Craner. Alex is the founder of Craner Analytics and iSystems Trend Following. I will link both in the description below. As a commodities expert, Alex has worked as a market analyst, researcher, and hedge fund manager. He has a wealth of very interesting information and extreme details as well on these topics. Alex runs a popular Substack, which I read on a regular basis and would highly recommend too. Alex, thank you so much for joining. It's great to see you again.
Thank you for the invite, Lena. Always nice to join you, and my warm greetings from Croatia to your viewers and listeners.
Well, thank you so much. I'm excited that you're taking the time to join us during your travels, and I certainly appreciate it. Alex, you recently wrote a wonderful Substack article, and as soon as I read it, I thought I need to discuss it with you because I know the audience will be really interested. So your recent Substack article begins with a stark warning that we're much actually closer to a direct NATO-Russia confrontation than most people realize. And you argue that long-range strikes into Russian territory aren't simply military operations, but calculated provocations, which of course they are because they fail to change the course of the war on the battlefield. And they certainly inflict temporary economic damage, but they provoke a stronger military retaliation from Russia. So, why do you believe that these attacks were timed to coincide with the anniversary of Operation Barbarossa? And do you think that symbolism plays a larger role in modern geopolitical signaling than many analysts and commentators acknowledge?
Yes, great question, Lena. I think that absolutely, I believe that this is the case. Because, as you mentioned, these strikes into Russia do not have any strategic rationale. They couldn't change the course of war. They couldn't reverse Ukraine's defeat on the battlefield. But what they do is they terrorize the Russian population. And I think the calculation is to exert pressure on Russian leadership to retaliate. That is to strike at the European countries that are supporting Ukraine in these long-range attacks. And by this, I mean countries that provide the technologies, the targeting, the personnel support that and satellite communications that enable Ukraine to strike deep into Russia. And so that could be any number of European countries, but probably primarily Germany and the United Kingdom, and then maybe Estonia and Poland and Romania, a variety of places. And I think that the reason why they want to expand this war largely has to do with the domestic political circumstances that they have at home. Because particularly in Germany, we have the rise of the AfD party, which, if elections were held today, they would certainly be the party forming the next government. And they have said explicitly We want to cultivate a positive, constructive relationship with Russia. And then in the United Kingdom, I think that there's a real risk of a civil war or a revolution breaking out in the near future. And so that, would be a development that the ruling establishment could have no control over. And through history, repeatedly, you see that when social revolt reaches the boiling point, then the ruling establishment yells barbarians at the gate because they want to divert people's anger to the external enemy. They want to send as many military-aged men to the battlefront, and they want to make sure that as few as possible ever return. Basically, they want to cull the male military age population because that is the greatest source of risk for their position of power. So we've seen many times through wars in history that warring parties would sustain absolutely unreasonable levels of casualties. And then, with age, with time, these stories are told and retold, and they give you always the impression that this is due to incompetence. That these generals just, they say the generals always fight the previous war. And so they don't understand the new technology. So, like in World War I, they still went with wave upon wave of infantry crossing the no man's land, and kind of like they were going to have a bayonet fights. But now there's machine guns, and the generals just didn't take that into account, so they ended up slaughtering millions of men needlessly. But this is not true. Concretely, in World War I, there was a British general. His name was Sir Alexander Haig. No, Sir Douglas Haig. And Sir Douglas Haig was responsible for about 2 million, maybe more, of deaths of British infantrymen. And we cannot talk about incompetence because Sir Douglas Haig went to the military academy. And he did a course specifically on the new technology that were the machine guns. So he knew perfectly well what machine guns were. And then he and Winston Churchill commanded battles in Africa in which the British troops used machine guns, and they slaughtered an enormous amount of uppity Africans, and said that they knew perfectly well what they were doing. And Sir Douglas Haig, wherever he went on the battlefield, hundreds of thousands of British troops have been slaughtered. And he was doing it relentlessly. It wasn't like one, two, three, hurrahs, and then, oh, well, this is not working. Maybe we shouldn't be doing this. No, he kept doing it again and again and again and again. And of course, he ended up honored by the British establishment. He was awarded all kinds of titles and a lot of money and properties and everything, and he lived happily ever after into his old age, promoting his books and traveling everywhere. And so this was clearly done on purpose, and I suspect that very, very often this is being done on purpose. So the war that they are trying to provoke against Russia now is probably largely motivated by this same existential anxiety that they feel that something really bad is coming their way. Particularly in England, after the release of these gang rape reports, the investigative report by Sir by Rupert Law, because this has really changed the nature of the problem in England, because so far the ruling establishment has been relentlessly shoving this problem into the memory hole, and anybody who brought it up was labeled as a racist, as a bigot, as an Islamophobe. And the people in the media kept insisting that, oh, most of the rapes in England are being perpetrated by white men, not by the Muslims, not by these immigrants. And they were almost successful at making this whole thing go away, because many, many people in England, up until maybe a year ago, if you mentioned the grooming gangs, would say, "Oh, that's some kind of a conspiracy theory. It's an urban legend. It's way exaggerated." But now we know that it wasn't exaggerated, that at least 250,000 girls in England were raped, in the most horrific ways, gang raped, trafficked, pimped out to other people. That this has been going on since at least 1955, and that the whole entire British establishment aided and abetted this process and these gangs. And that it started from the policemen patrolling the streets all the way to the Prime Minister and the royal family. And when the report came out, neither the government, nor the media, nor the royal family took any positions. I mean, imagine the greatest crime ever perpetrated against the British people has been discovered, documented, presented in a investigative report, fully credible, and nobody has a word to say about this. And so I think it's dawning on the British people that their ruling establishment actually is their enemy. And so this would be the moment that, the American professor of history, David Betts, he's been going around, and he was saying Britain is explosively configured for a breakout of a civil war. And now the British people have this horror to digest. I think it's going to take some time, but I think that the anger is brewing. So now it would be so wonderful to divert that anger towards an external enemy, Russia. And so, funnily enough, the day before the Rupert Lowe's report on grooming gangs was published, the British Special Forces boarded a Russian tanker in the English Channel, sailing through international water, as they're perfectly entitled to do, and then confiscated the vessel, dragged it into British waters, and then pretended that the Russians were breaking maritime law. And they captured the vessel, and it was a clear provocation aimed at Russians. And then the next day there was like a private yacht, like a speedboat, that was charging for a Russian warship, which then, after warning shots, was diverted. But there was it seems that extremely reckless actions are being taken, as though they are desperate for the Russians to respond in a way that could present a casus belli to the ruling establishment, that they can say, "Aha, you see, the Russians are coming after us, and we must all unite now and defend our homeland," and blah, blah, blah. You know how that goes. And now you have a completely different situation. And then in the media, you could see you would have media collectively start loudly banging the war drums, and we are under threat, we are under attack, there's going to be invasion, we have to defend the country, all the patriotic men have to volunteer for military service, and then you have that, barbarians at the gates, let's call the male population, and then we'll be fine. We're going to have the country full of vulnerable women and children and elderly, and they're going to need our protection, and yeah, we win again. And so I think that the Russian leadership understands these dynamics perfectly well, and so they are not giving them this wonderful gift of retaliating against these provocations.
One of your central arguments is that Russian President Vladimir Putin has exercised remarkable restraint despite repeated provocations, because the long-range strikes on Russia at the end of June, I forget the exact dates at this time, but this was towards the end of June, those strikes were actually meant to be a provocation. We're meant to, as you said, to effectively create a stronger response, which Russia can certainly do, but it chooses not to. And so on the one hand, we see people like yourself, and I agree with you that Russia has exercised remarkable restraint so far. But then Western think tanks argue that restraint actually reflects Russia's military limitations rather than Vladimir Putin's strategic patience. They say, well, Russia is collapsing economically. Russian military has, what is it, 20 minutes life expectancy. I think there was a report at the end of June, life expectancy on the battlefield. Absolutely absurd things that come out of these think tanks and also that are voiced by experts. So how would you respond to their arguments? What would be your response to the argument that it's actually limitations and weakness that drive Russian policy and not restraint?
I tend to assume that people are not quite so stupid. And I think that they know perfectly well that this is not true. But, if Russia has the overwhelming advantage over Ukraine, if Ukraine is being defeated, if Russia is winning, then you're not going to talk very many people into taking up where Ukraine left off. You're not going to get very many mercenaries to sign up to go and fight. So you have to create this impression that now is the moment where we can turn this around, we can defeat Russia. So come on, everybody, $2,000 a month, you get to be the hero, go sign up, become a volunteer, a mercenary, and you're going to have a great experience of defeating an enemy, being on the winning side, and so forth. And there's also another aspect to it, much, much, much uglier and more cynical. But many countries in the West bought a great deal of Ukrainian bonds, and those bonds are not going to be worth very much if Ukraine loses the war. And so, by talking up Ukraine's prospects, you're also trying to boost the price of their bonds, because I think the current bondholders would probably very much like to get rid of those bonds because they're going to be worth zero. And so I think this is also a motivation why they continue, in spite of all evidence in front of their eyes, they continue to desperately connect very unlikely dots and assumptions and daydreaming and wishful thinking into, oh, Ukraine turned this around and now they're on the winning side and they're going to be at the gates of Moscow any day now. So I can't believe that they're that stupid, so I have to assume that they know that they're lying, and there are good reasons why they would be lying. But we have to also take these lies with a critical mind, and we have to understand that they're lying for a reason. And the reason is that they would like, maybe they would like for me to sacrifice my son, send them to war against Russia, and they would like other parents across the world to do the same, and they would like us all to give up our money, our pensions, our everything to pay for this war, because there it's just about done. It's almost over. Russia is finished. So let's all go fight that war. And I think that's a fantasy.
Absolutely. At what point do you think Russia's political leadership could conclude that restraint is no longer sustainable? Because, we're talking about military response, but military response is, of course, driven by a political decision. So we're going to need a political decision in the Kremlin to say, okay, since our restraint is viewed and perceived as weakness, since our red lines are being constantly crossed by the West, we are no longer regarding ourselves to be, in this position that we need to restrain ourselves consistently. Do you think we've reached that point, or is it still sort of ahead?
No, I think we're past that point, Lena. But I think there's two aspects to this. One is the military military response, which would be warranted. You know, Russia would be justified in taking a very, very tough stance militarily and to respond to all these provocations. But I think that the Russian leadership is very wise in that they understand that by responding to the provocations, that they would actually give a lease of life to the degenerate European leadership, who can only stay in power for much longer if they could somehow orchestrate a war against Russia. So military response would be a retaliation, would be militarily justified, but strategically it would complicate things to the point where you could no longer predict an outcome. Because right now, you know, you can predict that all these ruling parties like CDU in Germany, Chancellor Merz, Emmanuel Macron, the Labour Party in the UK, they're all on a sharp decline. They're deeply, deeply unpopular with the peop with their populations. Now, if you pushed yourself into their desired role of external enemy, and you gave credence to their narrative that you are the external enemy, you would give them a lease of life. And then I think almost inevitably we would get the World War III scenario, which would be similar to World War I and World War II on the European continent. It would be again United Europe against Russia. And then, you know, the war drums would get so overwhelmingly loud that you could no longer present a dissenting view, because now they would say like, "Aha, you are a Putin puppet. You are not sufficiently patriotic. Are you a traitor?" And you know that then creates this like mass formation psychosis, as Matthias Desmond conveys, which would make it impossible for dissent to really play an important role. And it would make it easy for the ruling establishment to deal with any opposition in a very cruel, very, very efficient way. And then you create, you know, a totalitarian mindset that is only driven towards war. And, you know, ordinary people would have difficulty resisting this. So I think that the Russians do not want this to suddenly coalesce. They don't want the European people to rally around the flag and, you know, close ranks with their deeply unpopular leaders. They want the whole thing to dissipate. And I think that they will persevere in this. And I think that the tough military response will continue to be aimed primarily or maybe exclusively at Ukraine. And we have seen that the rhetoric in Russia has changed. You know, up until now, they've been talking about the Donbas. Well, now they're talking about Novorossiya. And what does that mean exactly? But I think that it means probably the Kherson Oblast, Dnipropetrovsk Oblast, Odessa. It probably includes Kiev. So it could be everything east of Dnieper. And I think that that's coming now. And I think that there's very close to nothing that the Europeans can do about it other than continue putting annoying scratches on Russia with these drone strikes that, you know, cause damage, a little bit of casualties as well. But, you know, Russians are not afraid of that. Russians don't freak out because a few people died. Russia has sustained 60 million casualties in World War II. They understand an existential fight. They won't abandon their leadership because somebody in their town got killed by a Ukrainian drone. It will only stiffen their resolve. So I'm afraid that these outcomes are irreversible. And from a strictly historical point of view, I think that everybody in the West should breathe easy about this, because this is ultimately the defeat of the Epstein class, which has been equally demonic on the foreign front, fighting these wars against Russia, against the Middle East, and so forth, as they have been towards their own populations. So, the sooner they end up in the dustbin of history, the better.
Looking at the news and reading the news this morning, I came across a report about a Ukrainian drone attacking a densely populated market area. And if anyone has been to Ukraine or to Russia or to Eastern Europe and many Middle Eastern countries, they know what an outdoor market looks like. It's just kind of elbow to elbow people. Like it's just a crowd of people. There are vendors, there are little shops. So it's very, very populated. And so Ukraine attacked this outdoor market on a Friday morning in the city of Takhmak. And you know what? Takhmak happens to be actually not in, what you would consider Russia. It's actually in Zaporozhye. It's that Ukrainian territory that Zelensky claims Ukraine must return. So then the question is why, if you feel that you're fighting, you're sending thousands of Ukrainian men to fight in this war to defend this territory while you're attacking the civilian population on this territory, then of course there should be many, many questions about the true intentions and whose interests are being defended and promoted by Zelensky's regime. And so that kind of goes to show that what you just said is it plays out on a daily basis in Ukraine when we see Zelensky regime actually, carrying water, for Western actors while deliberately and systematically hurting and abusing the population of Ukraine, who it claims to defend.
Yes, there's something very strange going on in Ukraine, Lena. I'm not sure what it is, but it seems to me that Zelensky's government and whoever are his handlers, and I'm pretty sure that we know that his handlers are in the city of London, that it's the MI6 and the British foreign establishment. And this is not, this is not just a guess out of the blue. When Zelensky became president, he went to London and he spent 2 hours in a meeting with Sir Richard Moore, who was the head of the MI6 at that time, which was extremely bizarre because he became a president of a country. So he would be meeting with the prime minister of that country as his equivalent, or with the king, not with the head of the Britain's Foreign Intelligence Agency. But that happened, and we know that they have been very close in touch and closely coordinated this war. And one of the big projects that the British foreign establishment and their intelligence agencies have been supporting is the Zionist project. And there have been now many reports with video, with very credible footage of them creating new Jewish-only villages and regions inside of Ukraine that are walled off. Well, they're fenced off, where ordinary Ukrainians are not allowed to go, and they have Jewish-only police force protecting those areas. And so that's extremely bizarre. And I would be curious to know if this isn't part of that, that maybe they decided to clear out Tokmak of Ukrainian people in order to create new ghettos.
Yeah, it could be. In your article, one of the things that stood out to me is your quote of Mark Twain's warning that wars begin with lies. And before going and discussing sort of the financial aspect of wars and bankers' wars, I'd like to quickly focus on this. So, in your article, you write, And I will just quote for our viewers. You write, "The loud little handful in our midst will be shouting for war until they manage to generate the mass formations that causes that would make the war not only possible, but probably inevitable, and Europe would fully share Ukraine's tragic fate." So you describe what you call a psychological phase transition when societies believe that war is impossible until all of a sudden it becomes inevitable. So are we witnessing this psychological transition across Europe already? And what shapes and forms is it taking at this time?
No, we are not in that, and we're not anywhere near that. Because I have lived through that phase transition, and it was a bit of a culture shock, because when the war broke out in former Yugoslavia in 1991, I was 21 years old, and I remember that literally days before the war broke out. I mean, maybe a day or two or three before the war broke out, the talk on the street was, it's unthinkable, it's impossible. Who would possibly want to fight a war? So the constituent peoples of former Yugoslavia, the Slovenians, Serbs, Croats, Bosnians, Montenegrins, Macedonians, we share, our cultures overlap a great deal. Croats and Serbs speak the same language. Serbian and Croatian are about as different as English in England and English in the United States, right? We understand each other perfectly. So we have very similar roots. Maybe we have the same roots. We were intertwined economically, culturally, even as families. My mother is Serbian, my father is Croatian, and this was perfectly normal. Most people didn't know who was Serbian, who was Croatian. It was just normal people. And so to think that these people who consider themselves part of the same national body, basically, would now turn against each other and go to war was just, it seems surreal. And so nobody believed it. And then, when the missiles started flying, when there were casualties, when the news cycle started showing us the pictures and telling us there have been so many killed here and so many killed there, and women and children and so on, that phase transition took place almost immediately. It was almost from one day to the next. And so before the war, you could have a nuanced discussion about all kinds of things, and you could say, the Serbs, they have a point about this, and the Serbs could say, the Croats, they have a legitimate concern about that. And life seemed ordinary, and then from one day to the next, it all flipped. And now, patriotism became the top value in society, readiness to fight and die, readiness to inflict violence, became, how do you call it? Well, I guess fashionable. Having a nuanced discussion became very suspect. Are you now not patriotic? Do you not love your country? Are you sympathizer of the other side? Are you an enemy sympathizer? So the voices of dissent went silent, and so you had the polarization to black and white happen almost instantly, and that is an unmistakable effect. So if that were the case in Europe, we would know, but it's not. We can still have nuanced discussions. I can say things I think, and nobody's going to come bang on my door and drag me away in the middle of the night. But that could happen again, if Russia decided to retaliate and drop a missile in Germany or in the UK or in France, Poland, somewhere, then that effect could happen. And then we're in a totally war game. And at that point, I genuinely do believe that the war becomes very probable, if not inevitable.
Alex, I think your personal experience during the breakup of Yugoslavia is one of the most powerful aspects of this conversation. What parallels might one draw between the war in Yugoslavia and also the war in Ukraine, which, is almost 30 years later?
In some ways, it's part of the same conflict. Because, as many people like George Soros and Klaus Schwab and others like to remind us, this is a conflict between systems of governance. And I think that Yugoslavia was, Yugoslavia being in the Balkans, made up of different constituent peoples. But primarily, Croats who are Catholic, Serbs who are Orthodox, and Muslims who are Muslim, right? This is a very fertile ground for divide and rule. This is a very easy place to provoke conflict and instigate wars. And we know that the British foreign policy establishment. Have been trying to rig, particularly Bosnia, which is like in the center of former Yugoslavia, and it is constituted by Croats, Serbs, and Bosniaks in the same entity. That they've been already kind of laying the groundwork for instigating this war, and the reason is because, well, also let's remember that World War I was triggered in Sarajevo, the capital of Bosnia and Herzegovina, because that's when a Serbian nationalist, Gavrilo Princip, who was, they were maneuvered by, ultimately by the British foreign establishment, but, they worked through Serbian secret service, kind of deep state, to assassinate the Austrian Archduke Franz Ferdinand. And then, World War I breaks out. So this is a good fertile ground for triggering another world war, particularly because if a conflict between Serbs, Croats, and Muslims erupted in Bosnia and Herzegovina, almost inevitably Serbia would be drawn in. And then almost inevitably Croatia would be drawn in. And if Croatia gets drawn in, Croatia is a NATO member country. So then that could be a pretext to activate Article 5 of the NATO treaty. And then you'd have potentially a united NATO response against Serbia, to go and pacify Bosnia and Herzegovina. Now, if Serbia and the Serbs in Bosnia were confronted with NATO, Russia couldn't stay out. So this was the scenario that they're trying to create is a way to draw Russia into a second front of this conflict. So the Balkans might become the second front of the Western war against Russia. And there's a very prominent British think tank called RUSI, which stands for Royal United Services Institute. Who even a few years ago published, I think about 2 years ago, published a paper saying that Bosnia and Herzegovina would inevitably be the second front of West's war against Russia. So they were planning this. And these plans have all been disrupted by the election of Donald Trump. And I've spoken with official of the Serbian entity in Bosnia. With a government members of their government, who told me that since Donald Trump had been elected, that the situation has calmed completely. It's they said it's like on a different planet, and the British are very, very annoyed about this, but they will not give up. Maybe they will wait out Trump. They will never give up. So that danger is still there. It's very much present, but the part of all this that I like to stress is that the war is actually for our minds, because I think that the whole European continent, the whole, let's call it the United West, is kind of balancing on the edge of internal conflict versus external conflict. So if people perceive the real enemy to be their own ruling establishments, they might turn against the ruling establishment. They might cause social uprisings, revolutions, civil wars, who knows? And so there's this battle for the mind of the ordinary European person, so that instead of perceiving their own ruling establishment as the enemy, they want to turn their attention towards Russia as the external enemy. So the internal conflicts might be completely sapped if you can turn public anger towards the foreign enemy. And so I think that this is now actually kind of on a balancing point, which way it's going to turn over. And so the ruling establishments and the corporate media, they're all trying to provoke Russia and tell us, like, look, Russia is the enemy. We have to go to war against Russia for sure. Whereas, independent thinkers, social media platforms, the blogosphere, the podcasts, they're all focused on the internal enemy. So it's literally a battle for the mind of the people. And I think it's highly uncertain, but that's a good thing, because there was a time when we literally depended on newspapers and radio and televisions to tell us what's going on in the world. And then they would tell us, oh, the evil Germans are bayoneting babies in Belgium, and they're raping women and chopping them up. But like all these things that were completely untrue, but people had no way to verify it, and they assumed that the newspapers were telling them the truth. So you could create this psychosis to say, like, okay, we have to go to war, we have to confront this evil from Germany. And then you got the whole World War III with its 20 million casualties. Today, the social equation has changed radically, because we can have these conversations and people can see them and hear them and consider different sources of information. And so they're not so sure. So if they tell them Vladimir Putin is evil, he's the new Hitler, people think, like, doesn't quite seem that way, maybe he's authoritarian, maybe he's aggressive, maybe he's really terrible to his people, maybe the war in Ukraine is unjustified, but I don't see him invading Europe. Besides, where did he say that he wants to do any such thing? He didn't. And you can see many of his speeches and many of his statements in first person. And you listen and it's like, well, the man actually sounds very reasonable and very rational. And look, he's not responding to provocation. He's very restrained. So the inclination to look at Russia as the barbarians at the gate that we have to unite against, it's not happening. So in that sense, I'm saying uncertainty is a good thing, because maybe before the internet, before the social media, there wouldn't be such uncertainty. The war drums would just be growing louder and louder and louder. Dissent would be overwhelmed and swallowed up, and we'd probably end up in World War III for sure.
I've noticed that one of the key themes in your work is you drawing a connection between the IMF, international finance, and the decision to launch military operations. Alex, talk to us about how the first, I guess, civil war in the Donbas in 2014, and then the broader war in Ukraine are indeed bankers' wars.
I've been working on a book about Ukraine, about from a bit in the historical context, but particularly the coup in February of 2014, and then the ATO, the anti-terrorist operations, and then the militarization and Nazification of Ukraine in preparation for war against Russia. And so there was a coup in February of 2014. And when the new government came into power, the new junta, they were quite content to be ruling in Kiev, consolidating their power. But the people in the south and in the east of Ukraine, mostly Russian-speaking people, they rebelled because the president Viktor Yanukovych, who was overthrown during the coup, he was overwhelmingly supported by the south and the east of Ukraine, particularly Donbas, right? He got something like 90% of the vote in the last elections before 2014. So they didn't accept that he was just overthrown by force, and then a completely new government, handpicked by Western officials, was suddenly ruling over them. So they said, "No, we don't recognize this. We will not accept it." And so Ukraine was starting to lose control over the south and the east, and the Donbas. And so the new government needed a lot of money. I mean, even Yanukovych needed a lot of money. So they were constantly in these negotiations with the IMF. And the IMF was always nickel and diming them. They were like, "Okay, well, we can give you maybe $2 billion, but there's all these," and then they would, like, we know from Nikolai Azarov, who was the prime minister under Yanukovych, that the conditions that they were imposing on Ukraine to obtain IMF loans were extremely harsh, to the point where they simply couldn't take those loans because they could not satisfy their conditions. And at the same time, Russia was being much more generous. Just before the coup, Vladimir Putin offered $15 billion loan with virtually no strings attached. And anyway, after the coup, suddenly the IMF becomes much more generous, much more forgiving. But the condition was you have to consolidate control over the Donbas and the South. So the junta wasn't quite, they were not quite ready for war. And the Ukrainian armed forces were not ready for war, particularly not against their own people. So they would send military units when the ATO started, which was in April of 2020, 2014. And then the soldiers wouldn't obey their orders because if they told them that you have to shoot at your own people, they just wouldn't. And so the IMF basically told the new government, "Look, either you crack down on these rebels and take control of the Donbas by force, or we don't give you any loans." And so that's the reason why the new government, the junta in Kiev, launched the ATO, the anti-terror operations. And let's say that the actual military action, which turned into a civil war, was largely directed by Western officials, because suddenly in the run-up to the anti-terror operation, you had all these Western officials who kept coming and going. Like Carl Bildt made 7 trips to Kiev. John Brennan practically set up a CIA office in Kiev, and he was there all the time. In fact, he was the one who gave the green light for the start of the anti-terror operation. John McCain was going there. Joe Biden
Nuland.
was going there on a regular basis. Victoria Nuland, yeah. So it was. And so now, why did the IMF insist on the Donbas? Because, okay, the IMF is a, let's say, a cutout of a global banking cartel. So these are largely private interests that masquerade behind an international aid organization, let's call it that. Basically, because Donbas was, I think, about 80% of the Ukraine's GDP, with most of Ukraine's coal, most of Ukraine's natural gas reserves and oil reserves. Most of the steel production of Ukraine was in the Donbas, so they were literally about 80% of Ukraine's GDP, which means also the tax receipts and so forth. So Ukraine without the Donbas was worth much less than Ukraine with Donbas. But the selfish people of Donbas didn't want to share those resources with the Western bankers, so it had to be taken by force. And then, we always have to keep in mind why these resources are so important, because if you take control of those resources, they become your collateral. You can issue all kinds of loans against those resources. And then when you issue those loans, those loans become assets on your balance sheet. So if you're a banker, if you're one of the bankers behind the IMF, then you think, my gosh, if we took control of all those coal reserves and natural gas reserves and those steel plants and everything, our balance sheets could grow by probably hundreds of billions of dollars. So, that's what you want. If the Russians keep control of it, then it's zero. So that's why once they installed the junta, first under Yats, Arseniy Yatsenyuk, and then under Poroshenko, they had them go to war against the Russian-speaking people of the south and the east of Ukraine to crack down on their rebellion, to force the new government on them, and to take control of it by force.
Absolutely tragic, and
Absolutely
I
tragic, yes.
absolutely tragic, and I appreciate you. I know it's a very complex subject, and there's so many moving pieces and so many interests involved, but I really do appreciate you walking us through the key points that are very crucial to understanding not only what happened in 2014, but what has been going on in Ukraine this entire time, and why it's in this tragic and devastating position that it is right now. Alex, maybe we can close with a question, with a broader sort of geopolitical question concerning the United States and its position at this time toward the war in Russia. There are many conflicting narratives going around. U.S.-Russian negotiations practically proved to be useless. And of course, Zelensky's regime is unwilling to compromise to preserve the lives of the population and to really preserve the territory that it can still preserve. But from Washington's perspective, what is the strategic objective today? Is it containing Russia? Is it just weakening Russia, inflicting as much damage as possible? Or is it something broader than that?
That's a good question, Lena. I'm not 100% sure because, I was one of those people who was very hopeful that the second Trump administration would lead to a very radical course correction in U.S. foreign policy. But it seems that this wasn't sincere. And if, because, so what, officials from Trump administration and Trump himself, they were saying like, okay, post-World War II global order is over, it's obsolete, it's a loser. We have to embrace multipolar integrations. We have to become partners with people like the Russians and the Chinese and so forth. We have to deal with other countries in a respectful manner and so forth. And so I kind of believe that because there were some credible policy moves in that direction, and particularly when the U.S. delegation came to Davos, the globalist central, and they told them, "Look, it's over. Globalization is finished. You lost. Let's build a different kind of world." And then there was a trade representative, Jamieson Greer, who made a whole presentation about the American system of political economy, mentioning people like Alexander Hamilton and Abraham Lincoln and Henry Carey by name. And I thought, okay, well, they clearly put a lot of thought into this, so they must mean it. And Trump himself, on a few occasions, said when he was asking for people to vote for him, he was saying, "Join me in the fight against the global financier class," practically in those exact words. And I thought he wouldn't be saying that if he didn't mean it, But and the whole this whole illusion fell apart on 28 February when he attacked Iran. And the attack on Iran signals something else, not an embrace of multipolar integrations, but a re-embrace of American hegemony. And so if that is the case, that means that their outreach towards Russia may have been an insincere calculation, maybe as an attempt to draw Russia away from its partnership with China, to pull Russia back into the Western orbit, and isolate China in this way, and also to maybe persuade Russia not to interfere, not to back Iran, in the upcoming struggle against Iran. They wanted to kind of gain the goodwill of the Russians to say, like, okay, it'll be between you and Iranians. We have nothing to do with that, so we will not support Iran. So maybe this is what was really going on. We might never know for sure, but it all definitely signals a maybe a bit more sly attempt to reassert hegemony. And the Western Empire's hegemony has principally always meant hegemony over the Eurasian landmass. And so it seems to me that, okay, United States is not a monolith. So there's people who want these things, there's people who want other things, return to American Republican tradition, reindustrialization of the United States, repair of the country's infrastructure, creation of good jobs, well-paying jobs, and so forth, raising the interest, the standards of living for the American people. But there are those people who are primarily close to Wall Street banking cartel, to their largest client corporations, who are definitely struggling to retain hegemony around the world, to continue being a colonial power. And since 28 February, it seems to me that it's the neocolonialist faction which has now prevailed and secured the clutch of the actual policy, which I think is going to ultimately prove unsuccessful. It's probably going to prove self-defeating and damaging to the United States, but apparently that's what they're going with now, full force.
Thank you so much for such a fascinating conversation. Really appreciate your insights, and it's always great to get your thoughts and expertise, and especially to discuss your excellent writing. I will link your Substack for our viewers to check it out and follow. Alex, thank you so much for joining.
Thank you, Lena. All the best.